in a sense, we are in a paradoxical situation. Because our subject is God and gods. And here we are going to talk about it for 40, 45 minutes. And yet, the great spiritual traditions all tell us that really speaking, that reality which is called God is beyond all words. The Upanishads say, yatra vacha nivartante manasah sah apraapya. From where speech itself returns together with the mind not having obtained. That is to say, not being able to catch in the net of words this reality that we are trying to understand. Nevertheless, there exist not only floods of words spoken by simple students, but there exist great scriptures, there exist great traditions, there exist the great mythologies of the world, which all talk about God and gods. So we are, as it were, trying to understand how humanity has approached this most unapproachable of all mysteries, how it has tried to say something about that which is strictly inexpressible, ineffable, beyond the limit of words. As we were told, it is important to human life what notion we have of God. After all, if we think that God can be angry and take thorough revenge, then we shall think ourselves justified in behaving like this, and people have done this in history. If we think of God as the forgiving Father, there is some hope that we shall adopt that as a social and individual moral ideal. It certainly matters, therefore, what we think of as God. And if we think there is no God, that's a possible position which otherwise intelligent human beings have taken. I say otherwise intelligent because there is a sense in which, as the Bible says, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. There is a sense in which to say there is no God is to be a fool. But that we won't worry about just now. But otherwise intelligent people have said, we don't see any evidence of the presence of God. And this is either a sad and tragic position, or it's a deadly position, like the man in one of the great novels of Dostoevsky, who said, God is dead, therefore all things are permissible. It's the complete destruction of all basis for moral law. So just keeping in mind the limitless importance of the subject, while also keeping in mind the very strict limits upon putting the matter into conceptual form and into words, we shall just do our best together. Now, theosophy, of course, makes this subject its first fundamental proposition. When Madame Levatsky has to say that in order to understand what theosophy teaches, you must understand three fundamental propositions. In fact, she doesn't say understand, she says get a clear apprehension, as though she didn't expect human minds to get as far as full comprehension. But apprehension, some sense of the presence of the thing, some approach to it. And she says, there are these three fundamental propositions, of which the first is what people discuss as God. Now, let us in the first place see a little what she puts there as the first fundamental proposition. Although to students of theosophy this is familiar, it bears not only repetition, but repeated study. This is what she says. An omnipresent, eternal, boundless and immutable principle on which all speculation is impossible, since it transcends the power of human conception and could only be dwarfed by any human expression or similitude. It's beyond the range and reach of thought. All right. we saw that this is also said in many spiritual traditions. Now, the point is this. If we start out with the postulate that there is one absolute reality which antecedes, which is there before, all manifested conditioned being. Because that's how we see things. Anything which you actually find in your experience is manifest, it's there, visible to you. It is conditioned. You always find that its nature, its presence, its qualities depend upon certain other conditions surrounding it. Now, if there is a single cause behind all these multitudes of phenomena, those things which are apparent, which can be seen or analyzed, are called phenomena. If there is a single infinite and eternal cause, then it is going to be devoid of all attributes. This is what Indian philosophy usually refers to as nirguna, has no attributes or qualities. But it's also, therefore, essentially without any relation to manifested finite being. We cannot say, yes, God or reality is there, this thing which I see in front of me is there, so the relation between them must be like this. We say things like God is above. This is philosophically incorrect, because that which is the cause of all possible existing things is not outside those things somewhere, in the sense that you can say one thing is here, God, a second thing is here, the chair or the table or me, and then this such and such is the relation between them. This mental picture which we have of God, some other things, both sort of sitting side by side, is a misleading picture. That is not how God exists. So she says, it is beingness rather than being. Beingness is an attempt to paraphrase the Sanskrit term Sat. You must be familiar with it, because we say Sat, Chit and Ananda. Now, to give us some approach to this, symbolism is used. And the first great symbol is space. Why? Because when we think in the ordinary way, we find that you cannot leave space out of any conception. Suppose I just try to remember what that chair looks like. I cannot leave space out of it. There is a location in space where that chair is. There is empty space surrounding it. There is a dividing line or a boundary, which is the limit of the chair, and then empty space begins, and so on. And whether I'm thinking of a chair, or of the whole earth, or of the solar system, or of our universe as made up of millions of galaxies, I cannot leave space out of the conception. But if I try to think of space by itself, I only end up trying to imagine a huge container. It may be so huge that I don't visualize its roof and bottom and sides, but actually I am imagining it as a three-dimensional container. Try it and see. There is no way of visualizing space by itself. Now, both these are characteristics of reality as such. You cannot leave out absolute reality from the conception of any one particular thing. Without that absolute reality, the one particular thing would not exist. And yet, there is no way of thinking of that reality by itself in the abstract. And then she gives another symbol, which of course is nearer to us, the great breath. For after all, we are not speaking of a drawing on paper, we are speaking of that which is the rock bottom, the foundation of all existence, of all reality. And there we find that there is always life and movement. We are not, again, imagining something which is hollow and abstract. Therefore, the great breath, with its characteristic of rhythm, going out and coming in. Also, this is not a guna. This is not a vikara. This is not something which changes or modifies the reality. Because if you have a man sleeping peacefully, his breath, of course, goes out and comes in. But you don't say, I saw a man and his breath. The breath is simply an aspect of what happens when the man is asleep. You may say that he was doing nothing, he was peacefully asleep, but the breath was going out and coming in. And so, symbolically, in Indian mythology, the whole business of the universe coming into existence and going out of existence is represented as the outbreathing of Brahma and the inbreathing of Brahma. This, of course, is to be taken purely symbolically. You must not suppose that there is a giant kind of person with four heads and a white beard whose breathing has to do with the universe. No, that's just a way of speaking to indicate the nature of ceaseless motion. Within our universe, you know, there is no such thing as perpetual motion. All motion is finite and limited by friction and other factors. In fact, it's one of the rules of the United States Patents Office that if anybody brings forward something to be patented which contains the factor of using perpetual motion or establishing perpetual motion, it is to be rejected out of hand, because perpetual motion is not possible within our existing world. Whereas the breath of Brahma does refer to the one perpetual motion which is there, because the one reality has the nature of life in it. Now, if we keep this in mind, we naturally ask the question, but then what is it like? Is it more like consciousness? Is it more like matter? Is it more like energy or activity? Now, all these points Madame Blavatsky has also taken in to her first fundamental proposition. And so, she says, spirit or consciousness and matter are, however, to be regarded not as independent realities, but as the two facets or aspects of the Absolute which constitute the basis of conditioned being, whether subjective or objective. Very interesting. Even that which we think of as subjective, that is mental or emotional, or maybe psychic or spiritual, has a material or matter aspect. And that which we think of as material, the table or the chair or the floor, has in fact a spirit or consciousness aspect. Of course, in the case, let us say, of a lofty mind meditating on a high subject, the consciousness aspect is dominant and eminent and apparent to us, but there is a material aspect. In the case of the floor, the tree, the planet, the matter aspect appears dominant to us, or is the only aspect that we can see. But in fact, there is a consciousness aspect. Therefore, when you take the three together, the transcendent reality, the spiritual aspect and the material aspect, you have a kind of trinity. And it is this trinity which is behind the whole of the manifested universe. And therefore she summarizes, there's much more in the first fundamental proposition, but she summarizes that there's the Absolute, the reality, Sat. There is its first manifestation. We'll come to this. The impersonal and unmanifested Logos, the precursor of the manifested Logos. Then there is spirit, matter, life. Life is something which is there, which always operates when spirit and matter interact. The spirit of the universe. This is what at the highest level has been called Purusha and Prakriti. This is the second Logos. Then cosmic ideation, or that intelligence which governs the operations of nature throughout the universe. This is called Mahat, the universal world soul. And therefore, ultimately, if you were to sum up the whole thing, it is, there is one reality, but in the conditioned, manifested universe, it has dual aspects. Now, this is taken, the subject is taken further in a very interesting way, again in the same book, The Secret Doctrine, towards the end of book one in that volume, in the summing up. Now, students are familiar, of course, with the item called the ancient source, which is the first item of that summing up. But that summing up continues. There are more items. And some of the later items, in fact, beginning with number two, something very interesting about this is taught. She says, talking of theosophy or the secret doctrine, the fundamental law in that system, the central point from which all emerged, around and toward which all gravitates, and upon which is hung the philosophy of the rest, is the one homogeneous, divine, substance principle, the one radical cause. Radical in the sense of being the rootless root of everything. And she says, it is called substance principle, for it becomes substance on the plane of the manifested universe, an illusion, while it remains a principle in the beginningless and endless, abstract, visible and invisible space. It is the omnipresent reality, impersonal because it contains all and everything. Its impersonality is the fundamental conception of the system. It is latent in every atom in the universe and is the universe itself. Now this is very important because it distinguishes the theosophical teaching, which is really the teaching at the root of most great spiritual traditions, from the popular idea of God. The impersonality of that divine reality. Now, we must not misunderstand. We don't mean impersonal in the sense of something less than a human person, something like a machine or an animal. Obviously not. What we mean is without the limitations of personality. Any personality must have its limits. Any person, however tremendous and great, begins and ends. There is a Otherwise, he wouldn't be a person. There is space in which he moves. He is less than the space. There are other beings, maybe smaller, whom he governs. But obviously, they are outside him in some sense. That is why to visualize God as a person has certain limitations. It is misleading. The impersonality of the divine principle is necessary. And this, of course, is stressed very strongly in the Vedanta, in Buddhism, which in fact does not use the word God, but when it speaks of the highest reality, it stresses the impersonality and the unconditioned nature of that reality. And those religions which appear to speak of God as a person, we have to realize that they are very often using poetic or metaphorical language. For example, one would think that Christianity very strongly speaks of God as a person. But in fact, it uses expressions like, around his pavilion there is darkness. It says, there is one tremendous incident in the Old Testament where even the prophet Moses is told, no man can look upon the face of God and live. And so on. There are hints. Islam is regarded as having a monotheistic, one God who's a person. But in fact, there is a subtle distinction between Allah and Al-Haq. Allah, yes, the creator. Though he's described in curious ways, we will see. Al-Haq simply means the reality, from which you get the familiar Urdu word, haqiqat, fact, or things as they are. There is a subtle difference. And the Sufi poets explain that the devotee cannot find God so long as the devotee behaves like a lover standing at the gate of his beloved and saying, please let me in. It is when the lover realizes that the beloved is not other than him, that there are no two beings, that he gets in, as it were. Now, these perceptions are very important. Now, you can see, therefore, that this is different from the popular attitude, because in one way, it seems to make God remote, not familiar to the way we think and feel. In another way, it brings God very close, because a particular person living in a heaven far away somewhere, it would be remote in one sense. A God that is in every atom, every point of space, that is within you as well as outside. A God that is behind matter as well as spirit. A God that is in fact the source of life and life itself. In fact, the secret doctrine says, we'll see that there is nothing dead or inanimate in this universe, not even a stone, because how can one life give rise to something which is dead? If everything has come from God, regarded as one life, then everything has a kind of life in it, though the way it behaves, the way it shows itself may be different. So we have in the first place this teaching of theosophy about God, who's both, to sum it up in the terms of the Gita, both transcendent and immanent. In the Gita, Sri Krishna says, I established this whole universe with a single portion of myself and yet remains separate. That which remains separate, that which remains unchanged, is the transcendent. That which has entered into the actual universe, every point of space and every atom of matter and every point of consciousness, is the immanent. It has emanated into it. Now, therefore, we have seen that it's neither spirit nor matter, but both. Now, there is a slightly technical aspect to this which students of theosophy are familiar with, the discussion about Parabrahm and Mula Prakriti. Mula Prakriti is the root of nature, the ultimate root of substance or matter. And it is said that even to the eye of the Logos, the first point of energy and consciousness that arises at the beginning of a universe, Parabrahm and Mula Prakriti do not appear as two. The Logos itself only sees Mula Prakriti as a veil thrown over Parabrahm, and Parabrahm itself remains invisible. So that when we say it is unknowable, ajneya, we don't only mean that it is unknowable to us because we are not properly trained or properly educated. It is said in the secret doctrine that that's a mystery before which the highest Dhyan Chohan, the highest angelic being, can only bow in silence and reverence. It is unknowable in principle. It's not just unknowable because you have to study more. It is unknowable in principle because, as the secret doctrine explains, nothing finite can take and contain the infinite in its consciousness. That's not possible. It's unknowable in that sense. Now, the summing up to which we referred, and students are really invited to go into the later items of the summing up, goes on to say, especially, that the universe, after all, we're not just talking about God in the air, there is the actual universe. The universe is the periodical manifestation of the unknown absolute. The unknown absolute, cannot be identified with a being of any kind that can be conceived by the human intellect. It's best described as neither spirit nor matter, but both. There's a place in the Key to Theosophy where HPB says, Atman, the highest human self, is not spirit, but metaspirit. It's beyond spirit. And the universe itself is Maya, in the sense that it is temporary, not in the sense that it's illusion, we'll just see. Because all is temporary therein, from the ephemeral life of a firefly to that of the sun, compared to the eternal immutability of the one and the changelessness of that principle, the universe with its evanescent, ever-changing forms must be necessarily, in the mind of a philosopher, no better than a will-o'-the-wisp. Yet, the universe is real enough to the conscious beings in it, which are as unreal as it is itself. So this, this friendly interpretation of the doctrine of Maya is very important. And then everything in the universe, throughout all its kingdoms, is conscious. That is, endowed with a consciousness of its own kind and on its own plane of perception. We men must remember that because we do not perceive any signs which we can recognize of consciousness, say in stones, we have no right to say that no consciousness exists there. There is no such thing as either dead or blind matter, as there is no blind or unconscious law. These find no place among the conceptions of occult philosophy. Now, we must keep in mind limits. Now, granted this, what about the vast traditions in the scriptures and the mythologies about the many gods? And the Vedas speak of them, the Greek mythologists speak of them, the Indian Puranas speak of them. Any country that you go to, there are gods of various kinds. What are they all about? The secret doctrine has a lot to say. So also the other work called Transactions of the Blavatsky Lodge. There wouldn't be time, it would take more than one such lecture by itself simply to explain the terms involved. But theosophy says, look, in the process of the universe manifesting, coming to be the way it is, the consciousness side, the divine mind side, as it were, of the one divine reality, is reflected and embodied at every stage in great conscious intelligences at various levels. This again is a universal idea. Only sometimes people speak of many gods, as the Greeks did, as the Hindus did, and as the Buddhists and Jains do, under slightly different names. Muslims and Christians don't speak of many gods, but they speak of angels and archangels. Now the idea is the same. Whether we speak of many gods, or whether we speak of archangels and angels, or whether we speak of Dhyani Buddhas and Dhyan Chohans, the idea is the same, which is that the infinite consciousness, which is one aspect of God, is reflected and embodied in this universe at the higher levels in great conscious beings who therefore guide the processes that bring the universe into existence and maintain it as a thing bound by law, not as a chaos. After all, the essence of the universe coming into existence is that there is a cosmos, an order, not a chaos. Theosophy explains that this happens because ideas from the divine mind are impressed upon matter at the very first stage. And that this link is called poha, that's a Tibetan term. In Hindu tradition, it's sometimes called Daivi Prakriti. One way or another, at the very starting point, matter is impressed with ideas from the divine mind. So that when you encounter matter in the actual universe, it is never random matter. It is never matter that's going to behave in some unpredictable way. It's never dead. It is already impressed with certain basic ideas. But that principle which links spirit to matter, call it Fohat, call it Daivi Prakriti, call it Divine Mind. At this minute, we can't go into all the terminology involved. This is reflected in great, very great beings. In the first place, seven archetypal beings. Those seven differentiate into many more. So that in many traditions, you have seven great gods to begin with. Now, these gods are only expressions of the one divine mind. and collectively taken together, they are referred to as the manifested logos, the Shabda Brahman, Vohar, sometimes Ishvara. Now, the term Ishvara is familiar in India. We would probably just translate it as God. But we must realize that among real Indian philosophers, for example, the strictest Advaita Vedantins, Ishvara is specifically declared to be the Ishvara of this one universe. But when this universe dissolves, the Ishvara will also dissolve into the Absolute, the Parabrahma. Therefore, when there is a new universe, there will be, so to speak, a new Ishvara. That is to say, the Ishvara, the highest governing intelligence of that universe. But all of such Ishvaras, in the plural, come from the one God. So you see, in a very high sense, theosophy is not even monotheistic. We would have to use the word of Shankar and say Advaitic. It does not admit a second. There is one reality which is without a second, Ekam Advitiya. It's not a reality that is put together with collective, by collecting together various other things. No, it is utterly transcendent. It is absolute. It is unconditioned. It contains the aspects of matter and spirit. And in the process of producing the universe, its thoughts are embodied in beings. Now, these beings are difficult to visualize. Again, the summing up to which we were referring talks about this a bit later. That summing up says that these beings, it's not possible to read all of this, this item 6, but it begins by saying the universe is worked and guided from within outwards. As above, so it is below, as in heaven, so on earth, and man, the microcosm and miniature copy of the macrocosm, is the living witness to this universal law and to the mode of its action. And she goes on to explain how I think of an action, and then all the processes are set in motion by which, let us say, my arm is raised and the action takes place. The universe is like this. The divine thought is there first, and that governs all the laws of nature. Now, at every stage, these thoughts are embodied in great beings, and those beings, as we said, have been sometimes called angels and archangels, sometimes called gods. So that you have in mythologies a god of rain, a god of the clouds, a sun god, a moon goddess, or sometimes a moon god. In Indian mythology, the moon god is male. In Greek mythology, there is a female moon goddess, and so on. Max Müller, discussing this kind of mythology in India, pointed out that you can't call it either monotheism or polytheism. That is, it's not the idea of one god or many gods. He called it henotheism. That is to say, whenever we're discussing one deity, we see it, yes, as one power which has certain functions in the universe, governing certain aspects of the universe, but we also see it as reflecting the one reality behind. And therefore it is sometimes addressed as the one God, as the highest God. It's curious, I mean, we had the Ganesha festival just now. You would find that there are hymns addressed to Ganesha which call him Devadi Deva, the original or first God among gods. And this is a curious thing to say about a God who is described very definitely as the son of Shiva or Parameshwara. How could he be the first God of gods? Now, Max Müller would say, look, this is a piece of henotheism. That is, you're not supposed to take Ganesha exclusively as the first God. But at the time the devotee is worshipping a particular deity, his attention is devoted to that form as expressing, as representing the whole of the divine reality. And therefore, without contradiction, Max Müller says, Indian mythology can refer to many different gods at different times as the highest god or the first god. Because in any case, none of them is seen as really separate
from the one reality. It is seen as an aspect, an operative representation of the one reality. Anyhow, the fact is there that we have in mythology all these gods and goddesses. The real question is, what is the theosophical advice about our relationship to these gods and goddesses? What about it? What shall we do? Now, that naturally brings up the whole question of God and prayer. That's another thing which all religious traditions bring up. Here, theosophy would really refer to the second fundamental proposition, which is law. The universe, as we said, is not a chaos, it's a cosmos, an order. Again, the great traditions refer to this. In Indian tradition, you have the word rita, an order which is simultaneously cosmic and moral. And it says that the gods themselves, meaning Indra and Vayu and so forth, all these Hindu gods, they are divine because they are ritavan, because they conform to rita. If they did not, they would cease to be divine, they would fall. So, similarly the Greeks, they talk about Zeus and Pallas Athene and Hermes and so forth, but they also speak of something called Dike, D-I-K-E, which is of course a Greek word, and they say none of the gods can transgress Dike. If they did, they would attract Nemesis. Even the gods would find that they were attracting Nemesis in the sense of a bad consequence to themselves. One cannot transgress Dike. Keeping this in mind and translating it into simple Indian terms, karma, because that is familiar to Hindus, Jains and Buddhists. But it is given a very clear definition in theosophy, and we say this is because all action, once it is launched, has its own consequences, and for human beings or for those human beings of any level who have a choice, it will have further the aspect of moral retribution, because such beings have motives and the capacity for choice that will bring about moral retribution. Given this, consider it in relation to prayer. We at once see that human prayers are of two kinds. There is the petitionary prayer, the prayer which says, God, please do this. Now, this prayer is philosophically mistaken. First, because it talks to God as if God was a person who can either decide to grant your wish or not grant it, as though it depended upon God's whim, as though you're just appealing to some powerful person and saying, please do this. That is not a right approach. But there is another aspect to prayer, which is the prayer of communion. The mystics and saintly people of every religious tradition have spoken on this. A prayer which is meant simply to bring the devotee's mind and heart into attunement with what he regards as the will of God, what he regards as the mind of God working throughout this universe. Theosophy adds something else. Adds meaning, it only points to something else which is there. In fact, in her book The Key to Theosophy, where she explains this point, Madame Blavatsky refers to Plato. There's a thing that you might call will prayer. If the human will is purified, if it's not simply asking something for itself, Plato puts this as saying, remain silent in the presence of the divine ones until they take the scales from your eyes and let you see what is good in itself. You don't ask them for any particular good, because after all your ideas of what is good are pretty limited. That's Plato's implication. Just remain silent and let the divine ones. There Plato's not speaking of ultimate God, he's speaking of these various great cosmic intelligences and powers. Let them unseal your eyes. And there is also, she says, such a purification of the human will by this process of remaining silent and waiting for the good to come. Such a purification that your prayer becomes a command to various powers which are there within you but which you normally don't know. Powers which are within you because, like the whole of nature, you are also a small scale microcosm, a small copy of the great universe. you are emanated from divinity. You are nothing, you don't exist, except as a reflection of divine power and divine compassion. If you can see yourself as that, and if then you will something, not what you will because, you know, as a person you like so and so, you are concerned about this or that, you want your son to do well in an exam or your daughter to get married. But in that state in which prayer has become a communion, you can will something. Let us say for the protection of a nation from a disaster. Let us say for the good of a world which is in a critical state. To some extent, as far as the karma of all the other beings involved permits, your pure, purified will become a command. And therefore there is such a thing as the mere presence of a holy man or a saint bringing a protection or a blessing to those immediately around him, or the whole nation in which he may be born, or the whole period of time in which he may do his life work. There is therefore such a thing as effective prayer. But it is not a question of a petition made to a personal God. It's a question of a purified soul putting itself in attunement with that divine reality which underlies its own nature as soul and spirit. Not its personality, but its own inner nature as soul and spirit. In that state, something very real may happen, and therefore there is such a thing as the blessing of a sage, the prayer of a saint, which will have a certain effect. Now, another thing, time is running out, is how shall we actually, what attitude shall we actually take to these great beings which we say do exist? They are angels, the archangels, the many gods of mythology or religious tradition. As to this, Madame Blavatsky once answered a question in her later years in London. It's in the Transactions of the Blavatsky Lodge. She remarked of various great beings, I won't read the more technical aspect which comes earlier. She remarked, yet it must be ever remembered that though they are gods, still they are not to be worshipped. This sounds exactly like the strict Christian or Muslim view. Why not, said the questioner, if they are gods? And her answer was, because Eastern philosophy rejects the idea of a personal and extra-cosmic deity. And to those who call this atheism, I would say the following. It is illogical to worship one such God with a small g. For, as said in the Bible, there be lords many and gods many. Therefore, if worship is desirable, we have to choose either the worship of many gods, each being no better or less limited than the other, namely polytheism and idolatry, or choose, as the Israelites have done, one tribal or racial god from among them, and while believing in the existence of many gods, ignore and show contempt for the others, regarding our own as the highest and the god of gods. But this is logically unwarrantable. For such a god, please note this, for such a god, again with a small g, can be neither infinite nor absolute, but must be finite. That is to say, limited and conditioned by space and time. With the pralaya, the tribal god disappears, and Brahma and all the other devas and the gods are merged into the absolute. Therefore, occultists do not worship or offer prayers to them, because if we did, we should have either to worship many gods or pray to the absolute, which having no attributes can have no ears to hear us. The worshipper even of many gods must of necessity be unjust to all the other gods. However far he extends his worship, it's simply impossible for him to worship each severally. And in his ignorance, if he choose out any one in particular, he may by no means select the most perfect. Therefore, he would do better, far, to remember that every man has a God within. A direct ray from the Absolute, the celestial ray from the One, that he has his God within, not outside of himself. And this is the crucial teaching of the Gita also. There dwelleth in the heart of every creature, O Arjuna, the master Ishvara. Take sanctuary with him alone. No need to go out. Take sanctuary with him alone. And we will close this already rather overstretched attempt to study a very difficult subject by reading something, a beautiful passage, again in the summing up, which HPB gives as a recommendation, the positive recommendation. All, again she is talking of the many gods, all are entitled to the grateful reverence of humanity, however, and man ought to be ever striving to help the divine evolution of ideas by becoming to the best of his ability a co-worker with nature in the cyclic task. The ever unknowable and incognizable Karana alone, the causeless cause of all causes, should have its shrine and altar on the holy and ever untrodden ground of our heart. Invisible, intangible, unmentioned, save through the still small voice of our spiritual consciousness, those who worship before it